Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Ruby Rogues podcast. This week on our panel, we have Dave Kimura.
Hey, everyone.
Andrew Mason.
Hello.
I'm Charles Max Wood from DevChat.tv, and we have a special guest this week, and that is John Epperson. John, do you want to say hello?
Hey, everybody.
This episode is sponsored by Sentry.io. Recently, I came across a great tool for tracking and monitoring problems in my apps. Then I asked them if they wanted to sponsor the show and allow me to share my experience with you. Sentry provides a terrific interface for keeping track of what's going on with my app. It also tracks releases so I can tell if what I deployed makes things better or worse. They give you full stack traces and as much information as possible about the situation when the error occurred to help you track down the errors. Plus, one thing I love, you can customize the context provided by Sentry. So, if you're looking for specific information about the request, you can provide it. It automatically scrubs passwords and secure information, and you can customize the scrubbing as well. Finally, it has a user feedback system built in that you can use to get information from your users. Oh, and I also love that they support open source to the point where they actually open sourced Sentry if you want to self-host it. Use the code DevChat at Sentry.io to get 2 months free on Sentry's small plan. That's code DevChat at Sentry.io. I don't think you've been on the show before, so do you want to give us a brief introduction, tell us why you're famous, how we found you, all that stuff?
Sure. I think famous is kind of the wrong word, but that's okay.
Infamous.
Infamous. I don't want to be that either.
Have you heard that line from the Three Amigos? You're so famous, well, you're infamous.
Yeah, that's fair. It's all good. So I've been doing Ruby for about 12 years now, since 2007. I just kind of like backed into it as my first job and have been doing it ever since. And done a lot of DevOps work on the way. I actually know Andrew Mason. I worked with him before. I still mentor him or whatever. I wrote this thing called Shiplane because I've been doing Docker stuff, and I've actually been doing DevOps stuff pretty much my whole career because I've worked with small companies and, you know, you wear multiple hats. I really got into Docker a couple years ago, but I thought something was missing, so I wrote Shiplane to fill that gap. It's a short story.
Nice. We should get you on Adventures in DevOps to talk about this one.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I felt pain and I wanted to get rid of it. And that's what Shiplane's all about. So
nice. Well, apropos to what we were talking about before the show, I felt pain too. I have kids.
No, that's
I'm
fair.
Just kidding. Anyway, blessing and a curse, kids. Anyway, I'm a little curious as we dive into this, just what are the problems you were seeing with Docker?
Sure. So I think the important thing is to start with why I liked Docker and why I cared, right? So for me, Docker was this promise that I could delegate a lot of this manual DevOps work that you end up having to do to something else. And that something else was smart enough and able enough to actually successfully handle all of it, automate all of it. One of the big holes that I saw was, okay, so maybe you have a Docker thing going on in development, which I know that you guys have discussed and we can talk more about that or whatever. And maybe you have a Docker thing going on in production, but what do you do to get it there, right? For me, if I'm like trying to define what DevOps is, I usually say, oh, well, that's all the stuff in between, hey, I did some work in development and I need it to be in production so everybody else can see it. All of that stuff in between sort of to me is DevOps stuff. And to me, everyone was hiring all of these people to push buttons, or you like, you get one of these SaaS services and you're like, okay, well, now I'm using ECS. Okay, well, I have to go log into AWS, configure a bunch of things using their tool, and then I still have to like go and push buttons in order to make things happen. And I was like, well, that's not really automated. I wanted something that like did all of it. So that to me was the problem that I was trying to solve with Shiplane. Still is. It's a lot closer.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I'm going to be diving into Docker this week, especially with Rails, because basically Ruby Rogues, they've just invited me. We're going to be doing a live podcast session at Microsoft Ignite.
Nice.
I told them I was going to talk about containerizing a Rails app, and I've never done it before, so.
That's what I was about to ask. I just listened to a few podcasts where you guys were discussing Docker, and that's where I thought you were, so.
Yeah, that's about where I'm at, so. About to hit a trial by fire, I guess, but it's not as straightforward as you would think. And at the same time, I mean, it seems like there are some tools that make it easy to get going. But yeah, then it's okay, well, I've got this container set up now. How do I make this work in production? And how do I make sure that production, you know, the production stuff is lining up with the whatchamacallit, the not production stuff, the development stuff. And yeah, you know, all of those things. And I do. I want it to be automatic. I don't want to have to think about you know, how many instances is it spinning up in the Kubernetes cluster, or did this get updated in the proper way, did blah, 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 so that it can go to production, and all of the things that I think we've talked about on this show before. So what exactly does ShipLane do to solve some of these problems?
So it has a few pieces. Right now, the working piece of ShipLane, so the thing that's out there in the open that if you go install my gym, you're getting, it assumes that you have a box out there, whether it's a VM or an actual physical box in your basement or whatever, and that you have SSH access to it. So that probably means Unix of some kind. I have no one testing Windows and giving me feedback, so until that happens, I'm probably not going to really actually solve that problem. But assumes you have a box, it logs in, it makes sure that you have Docker installed, then it goes, it gives you the ability to actually take your development Docker Compose, convert it to a productionized version, and it also gives you, it hooks in right now to Capistrano. So right now you're probably familiar, if you use Capistrano, running Cap Production Deploy. Well, it more or less replaces the Capistrano stuff with ShipLane's stuff. And right now ShipLane is using Docker Raw. That's the version that you're getting. So it goes up there, it creates a network for your stuff to work within. It deploys the containers that you want, and boom, your service is up and running. I can definitely answer some questions about that, but that's sort of the raw version of it.
That's interesting. I'm still beginner enough to where I'm not 100% sure which questions are the most relevant.
Let me pull it apart a little bit. So right now there's a few different like strategies that you can use in production to run Docker stuff, right? A lot of people are using Kubernetes, super popular. Maybe you could be using Docker Swarm. A lot of people are using Docker Compose in production, and there are still people that are using Docker, you know, just by itself or whatever. I didn't want to run containers by logging into my production machine and running Docker run with a bunch of stuff after it. Like, I thought that was dumb. And, you know, people then say, oh, well, you write a script. That's cool. But then that's a custom script, right? I now have to maintain that separately from my app. I didn't like that stuff. I wanted to be able to say my Docker Compose YAML describes all of the dependencies in my app. Therefore, I should just be able to replicate that to production. And that's more or less, that's what this one does. It runs it on Docker run. It logs into your server. You tell it, hey, I want these containers. You know, I need a Sidekick container. I need an app container. And right now on the two apps that I have in production, because they were small enough, I said, all right, I can run Redis and Postgres inside of containers and they won't hit any of the problems, you know, that I have. So it boots those up as well. I am currently working on a version that will basically translate your Docker Compose into Kubernetes YAML files. There's a few choices that have to be made, and I don't actually have a good app to test that on, because testing on a single container is like, it's kind of, there's no reason to use Kubernetes on, you know, my static website.
Well, and the Kubernetes API is ever-changing, and that makes it difficult to keep up with. They recently released version 1.16, and there were a lot of different kind of breaking changes with daemon sets and the different containers, so I can see where that'd be difficult.
Yeah, I figure that what I'm probably going to support in ShipLane itself is probably Docker Raw, maybe Docker Compose, and Kubernetes. And Kubernetes mainly because it's so popular. For example, I'm using Chef right now to provision, and I'm probably going to switch to using Ansible at some point, but I'm probably never going to make a Puppet version. Like, I'm not going to support it if you want Puppet. But I wrote it in such a way that if you wanted to create a plugin, you could, you know, use your plugin instead of using ShipLane's provisioning service.
Now, I'd be interested in seeing ShipLane do something with like an EB deploy. So will ShipLane automatically publish to a registry, whether a private or public registry? And then when you deploy it, it pulls from that?
Yeah. So the three main steps, right, are like bootstrapping your server, right, which is sort of, you have a server, you're installing Docker, whatever dependencies you need on it, right? The second step is sort of that build phase, which is where what you're asking about would happen. And the third phase is the deployment. So during the build phase, right now, if you install my tool, you go bundle exec cap, ship production ShipLane or whatever, it's going to build that Docker image and it's going to upload it right now to Docker Hub or whatever. Though I definitely, with GitHub coming out with their registry, I definitely want to try that. But yeah, it uploads it to Docker Hub. And then when you go deploy, all it's happening is it's downloading from Docker Hub, right? And putting it on your thing. If you go to Kubernetes, right, it's more or less going to do the same thing. It's going to pull down from your Docker registry and it's going to, you know, put it in a container and then a pod right there, right? And the same way, I think, with EB or something, you know, any of the other services, Google's Kubernetes service or whatever, right? You just need to have a registry somewhere and they can pull from that. So the only thing that would really need to change in that case would be, what's your deployment strategy? The build strategy gets to remain the same in that case.
Right. So the build strategy, just to summarize in like two sentences, is you build the container, you push it up to Docker Hub or something, you know, some and then basically pass it off to some orchestrator and have it run it.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary. I mean, people are writing all of these scripts right now to do it. People are already doing this in their CI, right? They spend a bunch of time writing these long scripts to do this stuff. And I just wrote a thing that I think contains a sort of sane path, right, to do it. And you can then, you know, just run that from your CI.
Makes sense. Or at least it makes sense to me.
I have been using Rails for about 12 years, and I was extremely inspired by Rails, right? So for me, the magic of Rails isn't that there's a bunch of magical stuff in Rails. The magic of Rails is that it provides sort of like this pathway, the same pathway through what's sort of a Wild West out there. And that's kind of what I see in the Docker world right now. There's a lot of choices that you can make. I was just listening to you guys' episode with Julian not too long ago, right? And he talks about, hey, look, you have to make a choice between Kubernetes or Docker Swarm. There's so many choices to make. And they're not wrong. But once you make one choice, it causes you to have to make other choices. And you have to know that. And there's so many choices to make and so many consequences from your choices. It's difficult to know, you know, your path. And so that's how I see Shiplane. That's why it's called Shiplane. The idea is, hey, look, this is what the Shiplane is. You can go wherever you want in the ocean. This is where everybody else is going, you know. And I saw that from Rails, and I like was trying to create that for Docker.
So if I want to get it rolling, do I just gem install Shiplane and then I have an executable that'll run, or is there more to it than that?
So you call gem install Shiplane. It actually right now is hooking into Capistrano, so you need Capistrano, but that'll come with it. It's a requirement. I haven't actually played with installing it globally or whatever, though I was actually pairing with Andrew Mason 2 weeks ago. And we talked about that, and it's on my list to try and do because we decided that that actually is probably a better way to do it. Right now, I suggest you install it in your app. I would say you put it in your bundle file. It's definitely tested that way.
And then you require it in Capistrano?
Yep. So you actually, there's generator, which should generate that for you.
Okay.
So I would say if you already have Capistrano installed, that might not interact perfectly well. But on a completely new app, that's what I would suggest you just generate from there.
Okay, so it has Capistrano listed as a dependency requirement.
It does.
Yeah, I will say when we were pairing 2 weeks ago, there's a bunch of example files in Shiplane right now. And just using those example files, like I had purchased a Rails template called Jumpstart Pro a few months ago, and I'd never really done anything with it. So I was interested in trying Shiplane out, so I took that because it's a full functioning app with Sidekick and everything already inside of it. And just using the example files that are in the Shiplane repo, I was able to Dockerize the app very, very fast. And then working with John like to Shiplane it, like I think got to the point where I could have deployed it, but I had some SSH issues with, what was I using? Some hosting provider I was using that I don't remember the name
of
right now.
You're using DigitalOcean.
Right. So I've never ever used DigitalOcean before. So I'm sure if I had, that would have probably sped the process up. But like in an hour and a half, I think it took me like 30 minutes to Dockerize the app. We spent like an hour and a half talking through some things and using Shiplane. And I think it's about ready to go. I just need to figure out some of those SSH issues I was having.
Yeah, I'm definitely trying to get people to test drive it and then like tell me. I haven't checked the Ruby gems thing, but I know that like last time I checked it, like almost 1,000, if not 1,000 people had downloaded it, but nobody had told me whether it worked or not.
So is anyone actually running it in production then that you know of?
I have two apps in production. I have a buddy that I made here in town or whatever. He's an older guy that's like retired, and he's been making like software for a bunch of synagogues. He's Jewish, and anyway, he's making like software for synagogues, and we're shiplanding his thing. Other than those three things, nothing's running on production right now that I know of. Yeah, 3,000 people have downloaded it. You're not telling me.
Well, hopefully we can get you some feedback.
I got some from Andrew. I actually took a ton of notes. And some of the notes I noticed, Andrew, for example, like I had said, oh, I need to document this or document that. And I discovered that I actually had documented it, but we weren't following my documentation. We were just kind of rolling. So definitely, gotcha. I feel like following the instructions is important for this, at least right now.
It almost sounds like it's Docker on, or Rails on Docker on Rails.
I wrote this as a general thing, right? Like, you do have to install a gem right now. But long term, I feel like this is something that applies to everything. Obviously, having a lot of Rails experience, I had a Rails app handy. I put that in the examples folder. But my goal is to try and get, you know, other things as well, because I think it's a general solution, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, you're going to have to be able to bundle right now until I create an executable out of it.
Right. I guess the other part of the deployment stuff is just all of the external things in your data in your database to go away. And so, you know, that, I guess that's all tied up though in your Docker image.
Yeah. So this probably is something that I was, after listening to this Docker episodes, I was like slightly expecting Dave to throw this question to me. But so I'm perfectly happy to put Postgres and Redis in Docker containers because I'm not even getting like one IOPS a second, right? So that's not really an issue for my static sites. But for people who are concerned about putting stuff in containers and or you actually, you know, have tons of IOPS per second, so you can't, it's intended to work out of the box with, okay, well, I'm just going to use Amazon's RDS service or something, right?
Right.
And put my database out there, or I'm going to have Amazon. I don't remember what their Redis thing is, but they have something.
Elasticache.
Yeah, there you go. I'm just going to use Amazon's Elasticache, right? So it's just an IP address that you point to, right? Or host name, instead of in your YAML files pointing to your local Docker network, you just point to RDS or Elasticache instead. It's just a configuration choice.
Yeah, I think when we start talking about containerizing services that are available on the infrastructure platform of our choice, like AWS or Azure, I usually step back and question, like, am I creating this infrastructure correctly? You know, do I need to be Dockerizing the Redis instance, or could I have a CloudFormation or something like the Jet framework to create a CloudFormation of that Redis instance and then use the AWS's AMIs to pull down the endpoint URLs, or not the AMIs, the IAM. The IAM profiles. So to me, it still feels kind of funny to have in either Kubernetes or in Docker in a production instance where those services are available to put them Redis, Postgres, and stuff in a container for a production use. If this is a staging or testing or whatever, then, you know, those have their own merits to put them in Docker to just simplify that infrastructure.
So I don't actually disagree with you on that, right? I think what you're advocating, it sounds like, is, hey, there's sort of a line here and some choices that I have to make, right? And I should make appropriate choices. And I agree 100% with that. But I think everybody falls in a different place. Like for me, I don't know if it's obvious, but the reason why I wrote Shiplane is because I want to think about things from a high level. And I kind of want to delegate a lot of the details down to something, right? That's why I love automation personally. And I don't necessarily want to purposefully make my staging and production environments and development environments different. I actually like the idea of making them all almost exactly the same. So for me, in situations mm-hmm. where I'm not running into the limitations of containers, who cares if I have a Postgres running in a container or Redis running in a container? In production, I feel like you're going to run into trouble. And actually, you've mentioned on the podcast before where you have a container that like sort of drops out, like as you pointed out, Kubernetes will like kill containers because of a health check or something, right? Which might have nothing to do with your Postgres instance itself. Process is actually probably the right word there. Those are the problems. Or high IOPS, right? Like if you're hitting the disk a lot, right? Like that's another thing that your container can struggle with. But most people don't have high IOPS. Like 90%+ of developers theoretically could run Postgres in a container and not actually run into those problems. I just don't think we're confident enough in it to really recommend it to everybody. And I don't want to be the person on the books that told everyone to do it. So don't do it.
Well, because I think that there is a level of abstraction that causes confusion. So let's say, okay, I do put my Postgres instance in a container instead of using the RDS that AWS provides. Well, where does my data go? How can I guarantee that that data is going to be persisted even through a persistent volume claim or mount? You know, where's that going to be? Is it going to be on S3? You know, so I think it raises questions that have not yet been answered.
Yeah, you're not wrong, right? Like the really simple response to that is, oh yeah, it just goes in a volume. But you're actually speaking beyond that, which is like, okay, where does the volume itself actually live, right?
Yeah.
I get that. There's still, if you're going to do that, you have some more questions to answer. It's part of the reason why Shiplane supports the idea of RDS. I mean, it just natively comes out of the box. You just have to point it somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
So for me, like not blocking that was important because I figured that's a really good, it's a good solution for most people. To let somebody else take care of your database makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, ultimately, and it's funny because before, and I still do this to some degree, but before when I was more on the code side and less on the running a podcast network side, I did a lot of things that were, well, I can do this, and so I'm not going to pay somebody else to do it. And now I've gotten to the point where I've got so many other things running that it's just worth the time, or you know, for my time to hand that off so I can focus on the stuff that's uniquely my problem, you know, uniquely something that I need to solve. So yeah, handing off those kinds of tasks like database management and things like that, it makes a lot of sense to me just to go, yeah, I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to worry about these other problems. And yeah, let Amazon solve that for me.
Yep. Shiplane is a delegation tool. It's designed to help you delegate things that, in my opinion, you shouldn't have to necessarily be an expert in to a tool, yeah. Right? You could do every single thing in Shiplane, and people are today doing every single thing that Shiplane does themselves. But I see people hiring these large teams to handle DevOps, and it's like, wow, that's crazy. To me, it seems crazy because most of what they're doing should exist. I felt like Docker already promised that to me, and I'm just like surprised that it's not widespread.
Docker, you lied to me.
Right?
Now, one thing I will say about Docker that is very attractive is deployment time. So if you're going to deploy a normal application, let's say with rolling restarts to a cluster of web servers behind a load balancer. So the idea is you want to take out half of your servers at a time, deploy the new code, make sure they're healthy. Once they're healthy, add them back into the load balancer, pull out the second half and do the same thing. Well, the nice thing about Docker is that you build your image, you push it to a repository, you have your production web servers pull that Docker image and then start it up. Everything is already bundled. All the assets are pre-compiled at this point, or at least if you're doing it properly with your CI/CD, building the Docker image and pushing it up to a registry, hopefully you're doing those steps. And then you deploy those Docker images. Well, to download a 200 megabyte Docker image on a production instance isn't going to take very long. So you can cut your deployment times down from maybe 5 to 10 minutes per web server down to like 15 seconds.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is a lot faster.
Does this work for things that are not Rails? I mean, I'm working on some podcast tracking stuff and we split one of the apps off just because it does stuff that's completely independent of the rest of the app. And it's written in Sinatra. And so I would imagine that it's pretty much the same, but I don't know for 100% sure.
Yeah,
it would be.
No dependencies on Rails. So I'm not deploying a Sinatra app right now, but I see no reason why it wouldn't work. And if you deploy a Sinatra app, and if you want my help, I'll even pair with you because I want more test cases. You know, we can throw it in the examples file or generalize it and then throw it in the examples file.
Yeah, that makes sense. It is something that I kind of want to get together. The other thing is I don't know how much the app is going to scale. And this is one of the promises that I feel like Docker and Kubernetes and some of the other ones have made, is that I can put it into a container. I can, you know, hand it off to my favorite cloud provider and they'll spin up and down instances for me depending on how much I need. And that way I don't go out and like provision like 10 extra servers for anything because I don't need them. And instead I get the promise of that kind of instant scalability without having to play any extra games to get it.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of Elastic Beanstalk, which a lot of DevOps people, I guess, consider it like my first cloud, but it has auto-scaling groups and stuff. So you can have a minimum of 2 T3 small instances, which aren't very beefy. They're not going to handle, you know, the whole world's traffic. But as the application starts getting more traffic, it'll instantly start provisioning new servers. Once traffic dies down, it'll start killing them off. So you're only paying for what you actually need. And with that, it does support Docker. So you can deploy your Docker containers to these EC2 instances, and then it'll start scaling those up just like it would with a normal ELB or the Elastic Beanstalk. So I think, you know, that's still my preferred favorite way to go. But I am interested in researching around to see pushing Docker images to Elastic Beanstalk just for that quick deployment stuff.
So Elastic Beanstalk itself is not one of the things that I'm specifically intending to be like a primary target, if that makes sense. I'm certainly not going to get in the way of it. It's just not one of the things that I want to support. And specifically because there's nothing wrong with Elastic Beanstalk. There's nothing wrong with ECS or Google's Kubernetes service, GKS or whatever. For me, with all services, also I'm writing tool into the ecosystem independent, right? If you want to pick one of these services, I feel like you're picking it because of the merits of your app. You're saying, hey, look, actually, I feel like Elastic Beanstalk is the right choice for us on this application. We only have like one dev or something, and that's not really in his wheelhouse. So we just want him to push features and we want EB to take care of all the production stuff or something. Like, yeah. I feel like you can make that choice on a per app basis. I feel like Shiplane, from my point of view, is sort of like the generalized path that you take to go from development to production, and you shouldn't care about what your production target is in the end. That's my goal with Shiplane.
Yeah, that makes sense. I could also see it, you know, if you're going to pick a provider that's not one of the big three, you know, Azure, Amazon, or Google, it's also a good option if you're heading that direction because, you know, let's say you go with DigitalOcean's cloud or whatever, right? And you're going to put it on Kubernetes. Then if you have an option for Kubernetes, it just works.
Mm-hmm.
Or mostly just works.
Yeah, I feel like if you're picking a SaaS provider, there's always the potential that the SaaS provider is not perfectly compatible, right, with the generalized version of Kubernetes or something like that. So there's always the potential that something won't quite work in there. But I feel like if we're targeting Kubernetes, it should work most of the time with most SaaS providers.
Yeah. And I think one funny thing that a lot of people aren't talking about with Kubernetes that a lot of these major providers have, so AWS, Azure, is that they don't support auto-scaling. They do from the Kubernetes level. So you can auto-scale your pods as the application gets traffic or whatever, but the actual cluster doesn't auto-scale. So what happens if your application starts getting a lot of traffic, it starts creating a lot more pods? Well, you might not have enough space or resources on the nodes to support that extra bandwidth or the extra resource consumption. So you would need to spin up extra nodes. So by default with Kubernetes, you might have 3 nodes. That's 3 virtual machines serving the Kubernetes software and orchestrating, you know, the pod organization. So I think that that's still an issue that we're going to have with Kubernetes right now in order to keep resources down. Because right now, if you're going to deploy to Kubernetes, that's going to inherently be a lot more expensive for smaller applications because you have that overhead of the nodes. Those are going to be more resource intensive than just having a separate virtual machine or Docker container for your applications.
Isn't it really funny how we're back to the point that we were like 10 years ago, right? Where everyone now is sort of forced to like over-provision hardware, right? Because we don't know how big our thing is going to be. I actually don't have that solved in Shiplane yet either. I do have an issue open on it that I do want to add in a sort of like Terraform level layer at some point where you have the ability, where Shiplane takes care of like provisioning boxes for you as well. I haven't done that yet because, well, you have to start somewhere, right?
Yep.
Someday in the future, Shiplane will do that for you too. Also, Shiplane will mow your lawn and all of these other things for you as well. But
nice.
Not today.
I'm waiting for that.
Yeah, I have some laundry I need done.
Hey, folks. I want to tell you about a great system that I just found that has made my life a ton easier. That's Cloud 66. A lot of folks think that deploying is a pain. I kind of grew up as an ops guy, and so I never really felt that way until I tried Cloud 66 and realized that the way that I was doing it with Capistrano, pushing stuff up to DigitalOcean, it really was kind of a pain. And when things didn't work, I had to go in and I had to bang my head against the wall to figure it out. Plus, all the setup stuff was just a big headache. And what I found with Cloud 66 is that it's a really nice way just to get everything set up. I just told it I had a Rails app, and off it went. It set it all up, it does the deployment, and now that I have other developers working with me on PodWrench, which is what I'm using it for here, all I have to do is give them access and then they can go push the button for me and it gets deployed. It's really nice. It's straightforward. It has all of my environment variables in it, so I didn't have to do any setup that way either. I just had to go in, put in my AWS credentials and a few other things that I was using for third-party apps, and it set it up and ran it. So if you're looking for a great solution for deployments, use the promo code RubyRogues, that's all one word, capital R, RubyRogues, for $66 off Cloud 66. This only works for new users, but man, it is awesome. So go check them out, cloud66.com.
I think we talk about this almost every time we talk about Docker, but one thing that I see predominantly among people who are talking about Rails and Docker right now is, oh, it's great for production and staging, but don't do it in development. It's too painful. There's too many problems, et cetera. And I know you have opinions on that. Why be using Docker in development? Why would you advocate for it?
My biggest thing is I actually flip back and forth between lots of projects. I get a lot of value out of Docker for a lot of reasons. And I think you guys have mentioned a lot of them that I, you know, just in the few episodes that I was listening to this morning or whatever. Things like, okay, we want to onboard somebody new. That's really fast and easy. But you don't do that very often. The thing for me that's the highest value is I flip back and forth between projects, and those projects have all sorts of random different dependencies. And the things that I would have to deal with to do that are basically going into, I would have to know what the dependencies are that I'm switching to and that I'm coming from. I have to go into Brew, turn off everything from the old thing, turn on everything for the new thing, deal with the random problems that occur. Even when you do that, you still have like randomness where it's hard. Like, for example, you can't have multiple versions of MySQL installed because they share the same folder on your hard drive. And so you have to pick one. I don't like that. I love the fact that I can basically spin up the Docker containers for one project, turn them off, go to another project, spin up the Docker containers for that project. I put a Docker Compose YAML in every single project that I'm involved in, and I just like switch to the project, pull it down, spin it up, and I'm able to work. I don't ever think about on a day-to-day basis what the dependencies are, and if I need to know what the dependencies are, I know where to find them. They're all in my Docker Compose YAML or my Docker file, one of the two places. Go ahead.
So I'm going to ask an ignorant question. So let's say you have really bought into the Docker Compose ecosystem and you are working on many, many different projects. Well, the API for Docker Compose has changed over time.
Yep.
What worked a year ago may not work on the latest Docker Compose today due to deprecations. So how do you handle managing your Docker Compose version, kind of like we do with our VM, for Dr. Compose with these various projects.
So that is kind of true. When you write a Docker Compose YAML file, you put the version of the API that it's using up at the top. I don't know of a thing where, you know, my old Docker Compose YAML files that I haven't updated that version don't work on the Docker, whatever Docker Compose I have installed currently on my machine.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So you're probably familiar with it because you do this in Kubernetes too, right? You say, hey, look, this is the this YAML file that I wrote is using this version of the API. So when Kubernetes goes through and reads that YAML file, it reads it and knows what's going on because it just uses that version of the API to interpret it, if it makes sense.
Yeah, I was running into an issue the other day where I was getting a Docker API version error. So this is a step back from Docker Compose. And it's because I, on my host, had a different Docker version than the API that I had in my .rc file was set to an older version. And it caused some, you know, just a small headache. But I started thinking, like, what happens if I then work on a different project that relies on a different Docker API version?
So I don't have an example that matches yours exactly, but what I would say is that I do have this 5-year-old Docker Compose file that's still working today, and I haven't changed the API version. So I feel pretty confident that it's mostly working in most cases.
I will say, though, you can specify the version, but kind of what Dave was alluding to, like I ran into this the other day where my Docker Compose version was the same, or it didn't change, but Docker updated on my computer. So like Docker machine for Mac or whatever it is. And that, for whatever reason, brought in changes that broke one of the things I was doing that had previously worked.
So two people saying the same thing. Did this happen recently to both of you? Because maybe there's a recent problem.
So I wouldn't even say that my use case is a special snowflake. I think it's more on the idiotic train where our development environment is just overly complicated with Kubernetes running locally in Minikube. So I think my situation is just very painful. Yeah.
But so I do have hear what an Andrew's opinion saying. On that.
Yeah, so do I.
I would say I definitely agree with you on that. Don't run Kubernetes locally. For the most part, it makes little sense. Because what benefit are you getting? Are you testing that your orchestration tool works in development?
Let's say you're working on a beautifully architected application with hundreds of microservices that are not actually independent microservices, but they are all 100% reliant on the others being up and running in order for the application to even function properly. So very poor architecture from the beginning. And so to have them all up and running in a Docker Compose would be not only a monstrosity of a Docker Compose YAML file, but it would also be difficult because if one goes down, then your application doesn't seem to be working. Is it not working now because of the code that you just changed, or is it something else? So Kubernetes, in that sense, when you're dealing with a bad situation, makes it a little bit worse, but also a little bit better at the same time when developing locally.
Yeah, so in this case, I think you have a special snowflake.
Yeah, I'm confused because you started off with a beautiful orchestration and then it ended up into some nightmare. So,
yep. I love getting pulled in onto projects. It's fun.
I definitely would say that to me, I think you're using Kubernetes in that case. And I think that's what you're saying, to specifically solve a problem that was self-made.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I can't help you there. I mean, if you hire me, I maybe could help you, but...
All right. Anything else that we should jump on with Shiplane? I'm just looking over my notes here and trying to, yeah. I mean, you've talked a lot about where you think this is going to go. Do you feel like tools like Shiplane are kind of the next stage in where we're headed with Docker and containers and things like that? Or are we going to move into another space where, you know, Docker and containers is kind of a stepping stone into something new?
So that's actually, I was thinking about headed sort of in that direction. So to prep for that, I listened to a talk a few years ago at a RailsConf where somebody was talking about this idea of we have We have pioneers, settlers, and townsfolk, sort of, right? Like these ideas.
Was that Brandon Hayes talk?
That sounds right. But I sort of internalized this, right? This idea that like there are people that are totally like the first to any new thing out there. There are people that sort of kind of come along. They're pretty soon after, and they build a lot of the tools, and they end up, you know, building the buildings in town, right? And the townsfolk sort of wait till everything's like cool and ready, right? I think that we're still in the settler phase, in my opinion, in Docker. I don't think all the tools are made. In my particular case, I wrote Shiplane because I thought there was this massive hole out there that no one had filled. So I do think that we're still in that tool phase. I think there's potentially competitors to Docker that may come along, but I don't think that's going to change the fact that like I think as a whole, our developers have sort of like switched, like containers are a thing. We're going to keep using them just like we use VMs all the time. I think containerization is going to stick. Maybe we end up switching to a different tool that's not Docker, but that doesn't mean that Kubernetes or Shiplane or all these tools that are built to make it work are going to break.
Yeah, it's very similar to front-end development, right? Where we saw React pioneer things like the Shadow DOM and components and things like that. And now Angular and Vue and, you know, half of the less well-known ones have kind of moved in that direction too.
Sure, and they're competing, right? Like, yeah. React isn't necessarily king anymore. I think it still is by numbers, but at least by mindshare, that's always muddy.
Yeah, well, and it's also interesting too, because when you look at those numbers, yeah, React is the biggest, I guess, by numbers and usage. But the flip side of it is that the Angular community hasn't quit growing. It's just not growing as fast as React is.
Yeah.
And so it's bigger than it's ever been. It's just by comparison on search volume and things like that. React is getting bigger faster. And so it helps everybody.
I'll give this plug. So just think of the kind of problems that Facebook had to have had to come up with a solution like React, like that kind of garbage, and to say like, look how much better our lives are now that we are using this garbage instead of this older garbage. Sorry.
Wow, that was an opinion.
Yeah, Dave and I get like one dig in.
We had such bad problems that we just invented slightly less bad problems.
Yeah. Yeah, same for Kubernetes and Google. You know, like what kind of problems did they have that they were like, oh, look, this is so much better. Like I can see where there's nice benefits to both React and to Kubernetes, but it's like, wow, like things must have really sucked beforehand.
I have a lot of opinions. I've been developing for 12 years, right? Like I have opinions about things, but I try to reserve them unless you're having beers and scotch with me most of the time because other people have opinions and yeah, can get rough.
Yeah. I know I definitely hold the unpopular opinion towards Docker and towards front-end frameworks, but I stand by them.
Okay. So one thing that's really important to me is that we have people in development that have different opinions than us, right? So a long time ago, when I was in college, I got this, it was my first car that I'd ever bought and it was a stick. And my now wife was my girlfriend at the time. And she didn't want to drive with me because she was like terrified. Like every time you shift, you know, it would like jerk a little or whatever. She was like totally terrified. She hated it. She thought sticks were stupid and all this stuff. And I became a really good stick driver because I was trying to prove to her that it was pretty awesome, right? That I could do it. And I feel like that's important. Like in development as well, like for people to have these different opinions, because without these, if you like all agreed with me and jumped on Shiplane today, there would be nobody questioning what I'm doing. And it would, you know what I mean? I wouldn't solve half the problems that I'm going to end up solving.
Yeah, I agree. I think a healthy conflict of opinion is good.
So back to the thing that we were yapping about before we had cool opinions about things. I do think that Docker is probably going to stick around for a while. I don't really see any of the competitors, at least yet, jumping out of the woodwork and unseating it. They could, but I definitely don't see containerization disappearing.
Yeah. I think the main thing that would even remotely threaten Docker would either be going back to the bare metal style or going serverless. but serverless has its own enormous amount of headaches.
I don't think that serverless kills Docker, because I think that Docker, you just put a Docker image. I think the serverless is going to make use of Docker, if that makes sense. Like, I think that's, they're going to marry rather than
compete. I see it both ways. I agree with John. Yeah, a lot of the serverless stuff, yeah, it's just a highly specialized Docker. And so when you send more traffic to it, they're orchestrating a ramp up and ramp down just like anything else, right? And so they'll send it to a warm instance, and then if they don't have a warm instance, then they'll take the Docker image that they built with your function and run it on a cold instance. But what's really interesting too is that, and to Dave's point, there are trade-offs between the two approaches. And so I don't see one cannibalizing the other unless it generalizes in a way that keeps sort of the simplicity and the niceties of the particular solution, and then makes things a lot easier for the other solutions that are afforded by the other solution we're talking about. So, and I just don't see them doing that. I mean, the nice thing about serverless is that you write a function and it runs it, and it's really simple. And the nice thing about Docker is that you can do your setup once and you can run it on development and in production. And, you know, with typically the idea is that, you know, with very minor adjustments, if any at all, you can run it in both places and it'll work, and you don't have to go orchestrate a setup of a new server every time you need to spin up. You just spin up a new Docker instance and you're off, or a new container, and you're off to the races. And so your overhead goes down because you don't have to go and fiddle with, you know, 10 different servers all load balanced to do the same thing.
I think that
they solve different problems, and they solve them in different ways, and they have different trade-offs. So
that's actually the comment that I was going to make, is I think that really in the end, serverless is solving a certain class of problems, or I'm sorry, is aimed at a certain class of problems, and your server architectures are aimed at a different class of problems. There's probably Venn diagram overlap here or whatever, but I think that if you're using serverless to try and solve something that a server client architecture does better, you know, that's the same thing if I like go run out and use MongoDB to store a bunch of, you know, if I know exactly what my data looks like, it works really well in a relational database, and then I go store it in Mongo, I'm using a poorly optimized solution, right? I'm just going to have trouble.
Well, and that's the beauty of the entire ecosystem, is the fact that if I find that serverless is solving my issue, then, you know, great, right? And if I find that it's not, and that I need something a little bit more sophisticated, I go create my own Docker container, and that solves my problem, you know? And it doesn't make anybody else using serverless wrong. It just means that for my solution and the way that I'm thinking about my problem, I need to go use Docker instead of serverless. It's the same thing with, you know, the front-end framework wars, as some people put it. I see a lot of the core teams collaborating because they're all trying to solve the same problems. And then ultimately, the way that they approach the solution, some people really like Angular, and some people really like React, and some people really like Vue, and some people really like Ember. And at the end of the day, the problem gets solved, and it gets solved in a way that makes people happy.
It is easy to drag me into philosophical conversation. I'm trying to avoid that here. My only thing...
Say what you think. Go for it.
I think that the reason why people like do these wars are, at the end of the day, they sort of see it as a way of preserving their job, right? If I'm a React developer and Vue becomes super popular, then maybe no one will want to use React anymore, and I'll have a hard time finding another job, or my job might decide to switch to Vue, and I'm not really interested in switching to Vue because I'm a React developer. I feel like, not necessarily that every single person is thinking like this, but there's sort of this protecting the thing that you know, right, by devaluing other things.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's job security. I think a lot of times it's just, we want to be right. And, you know, so we do have something to lose, but a lot of times I think it's ego rather than work. But yeah, that's why we bash on anything. That's why we tear other people's buildings down, is because there's something to be gained by having the tallest one. And so instead of building ours higher, we go tear the other one down.
Yes, I definitely ignored that human condition, so to speak, which we seem to have a lot of in our world.
Yeah, and it's not everybody, it's not all the time, but I think we all have the tendency to at least go there. So,
backing out of this deep hole we found ourselves in, are there any questions about Shiplane that you guys have? In my opinion, to summarize, Shiplane is awesome because it's trying to solve, or it's trying to at least help you solve this thing for you. My goal, right, like I said, is to create that pathway for us. So I think you all should love it and try it out. Let me know if you try it out and it's broken. I can't fix stuff that I don't know about yet. It works on my machine, so.
So one quick off, sort of off-topic question. Where did you come up with the logo for Shipline?
So being involved in Charlotte Devs, this organization in my town, somebody was helping me out to kind of, with the organization, get it running. And she used to be involved in like branding. And I have my own consulting firm. She was helping me with branding for my consulting firm. And while we were doing that, she hooked me up with somebody who made us this really sweet logo. And if you were RailsConf and you got like every, I brought 1,000 stickers to RailsConf and I came home with less than 100. Like, so people seem to like the logo. I think it's sweet. So my product is awesome, really, because cool. I have an awesome logo, clearly.
Yay. I mean, the marketing is to some degree it's an area that is often neglected in open source projects. So
it wasn't that bad because it kind of happened alongside, you know, getting a logo made for my company. So it wasn't too expensive to be made. I'm not that awesome of an artist. I wish I was, but somebody else made it and it's sweet.
Nice. A couple of years ago, I put out a survey asking people what topics they wanted us to cover on devchat.tv. And I got two overwhelming responses. One was from the JavaScript community. They wanted a React show. And the other one was from the Ruby community and they wanted an Elixir show. So we started both. The React show, though, is React Roundup. And every week we bring in people from the React community and we have conversations with them about React, about the community, about open source, about what goes into React, how to build React apps, and what's going on and changing in the React community. So if you're looking to keep current on the current React ecosystem and what's going on in React, you definitely need to be checking out React Roundup. You can find it at reactroundup.com. All right, well, let's go ahead and do some picks. Dave, do you have some picks for us?
Yeah, sure. So one pick is going to be the Grapes.js, and it's not a framework per se, but it's a WYSIWYG editor, but more of a full-fledged one. So if you remember Mercury back in the day, it's kind of like that, where you can do an entire web page building with drag and drop components and that kind of stuff. So I've been playing around with that recently for a new project, and it seems to be the most full-featured open source and most well-done library. So that's my first pick. And my second pick is Mario Kart Tour. So released today, September 25th, is the Mario Kart Tour for iOS, and it's a lot of fun. It brings back a lot of memories of Super Mario Kart and stuff.
Ah, the good old days. Yeah, I remember playing. I still play Mario Kart with the kids anyway. Andrew, do you have some picks for us?
Yeah, I mean, I was planning on working today, but it looks like I'll be playing Mario Kart.
Thanks, so, Dave.
You're welcome.
I love Mario Kart. I've been playing it since I can remember. But my first pick is today, I believe today, or maybe, starting on October 1st, Hacktoberfest starts, and you can register now. And I think that's a great program to help get more people in open source. So you can check out, we'll put a link in the show notes, but go ahead and sign up, read through the rules, and I would really encourage everyone to take advantage of it. And you get a cool shirt. So my second pick is, you know, Chuck brought me on this podcast several months ago, and I've been doing it ever since. I've always enjoyed it, and I've made a lot of good connections through it. And I'm actually joining Code Fund in a week or two with with Nate and Eric. So Eric used to be on the show. Nate couldn't be here today, but yeah. So my pick is Chuck. Thanks, Chuck, for
I didn't do it, man.
Giving me the opportunity, letting me meet more people, taking a chance on me, who has relatively low experience. But yeah, I'm joining Code Fund, so I'm pretty excited about that.
I always think it's funny when people give me credit for that kind of thing. You know, I introduce people and then they're like, Chuck did me this solid. I'm like, I introduced you to my friends, man. It took me 5 seconds. You did the rest. So kudos to you, not to me. I didn't do the work. And if you weren't the kind of person you are, they wouldn't hire you. So I take very little credit. I'm going to jump in with a few picks. So one of the things that I've been working on is just, I feel like I'm constantly rearranging my office. I've been working on getting some stuff together because I want to start doing some video and green screen magic. You can see that I've got kind of a white sheet thing behind me. That was part of me playing with it, and I just haven't moved it. But it's sitting literally in the middle of my office. It's a terrible place to put it. And so I've been moving stuff around. But one of the things that I've been running into is that on my desk, I feel like it just got super crowded. I have a bunch of screens in front of me, and they were all sitting, you know, maybe 3 inches off my desk. And it just took up a ton of space that, you know, I couldn't see through to the window. And anyway, so I found these online there, and I'll put a link to them in the show notes. But they're basically a VESA adjustment for your monitors. So you attach the plate to your monitor stand that, you know, has the four holes on the back that you screw stuff into. And then the other one you screw onto the back of your monitor, and it has a kind of a ratcheting system where you can move your monitor up and down and it'll hold it in place. And so I was able to raise my monitors like 6 inches. And so they're up higher, kind of where I really want to be looking when I'm working. And it's made a huge difference, and it's opened up a ton of space and options for my desk. And so I'm going to pick that. The other thing that I'm going to pick as far as desk organization goes, I got on Amazon for like 10 bucks, I got 100 Velcro strips. They come in rolls. I'm going to hold them up for the panel, but you know, obviously this is audio, so you can't see it. But yeah, they're what, like 3-4 inches, 5 inches long. So I'm using those to organize my cords. Because when I use zip ties and then I have to put another cord on, then I have to cut the zip tie off and everything, which is something that I've done in the past. I've been basically attaching the cords to the monitor arms, and then, you know, and that way they just run down the pipe and they're not all over the place. And then I can, you know, feed them into the, you know, I have holes in the top of my desk that, for feeding cords through and all of that stuff. But then I can keep it all together, and then I don't wind up, you know, when I put my feet up, because I have a really small ottoman under my desk, so I can put my feet up while I'm working. I'm not kicking the cords or anything because they're all out of the way. So I'm really liking that, and it makes it easy to, oh, I'm putting some other device on my desk, so I'm just going to wrap the cords in with the other cords and problem solved. So
another pro tip there, Chuck, for desk organization is get command strips, the 3M command strips. Put them on your surge protector and then bottle mount it on the bottom of the desk.
Ooh, I like that. I'm going to have to do that because, yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I have a UPS, an uninterrupted power supply. It's basically a giant battery that plugs into the wall, and then all your stuff plugs into it. And I bought it years and years and years ago. And so that probably won't work for that because it's too heavy. But the other power strip that I have, that would work for that. I don't need the UPS. I've kind of figured that out in the years since. But it's a big power strip, so I can use it, and it acts as a surge protector. So
they usually have mounting holes on the back, so you can put like a screw into something.
Yeah.
And you can mount it that way too.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of the power strips have that. Yeah, good ideas. Dang, there goes my afternoon. Andrew's going to be playing Mario Kart, and I'm going to be screwing stuff to the bottom of my desk. John, do you have some picks for us?
I actually do. Are you guys, is this too PG for me to recommend a scotch? Or
go for it. On Ruby Rogues, Avdi used to do beer picks every week. So
awesome. I couldn't remember. And now that you say that, I remember something along those lines now. Okay, so I'm pretty big into scotch. I have been for some time. I certainly don't consider myself the premier expert in the world, but I've had a long journey. And my current favorite scotch of 3 years now, which is the longest that I've, you know, that it's been my favorite, is this Glen Scotia 15 year. It's pretty awesome. So if you've like never done scotch before, this is about $100 a bottle. So it's probably, you know, not everybody's, it depends on what your budget is and stuff, but it's totally worth it's. It's pretty awesome. It's got like notes of caramel in it. It probably is the most, has the most notes of any scotch that I've ever had. And I tend to value those pretty highly. It's also supposed to be like, if you don't like peaty scotches, this isn't going to bother you, things like that. So I think it's a really easy scotch for people to drink. So I recommend it to people all the time. So that was my first pick. And then I also have a book. So I'm really into, I've always been into reading fiction. And I happen to have a friend that I went to college with that ended up becoming an author, and he's a few books in now, and he's clearly getting better with every book, but he just published this book, I think this week. He sent me an email when it came out, and I think it came out this week or whatever, but it's called Immortals, and there'll be like a link to it or whatever. But I believe it's a second book in his series, something like that or whatever. He like went back and changed how things fit in order. He's gotten a lot better and his books are pretty solid at this point. So definitely, if you're into fiction and you're like kind of like tired of what's out there, like this is pretty good entry in my opinion. So I got to pre-read it, so I've already read it. It's nice. Good.
Yeah, I've got a couple of programming books that I want to write, and then I'll probably write some fiction.
Awesome. Send it my way. I'm totally into fiction.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my friends from high school actually works for him, but one of my favorite authors is Brandon Sanderson.
He works for him?
Dude, he works for him, yeah. He works for him doing social media and mailing out swag and stuff like that.
Wow. In my opinion, I think that Brandon Sanderson is likely to be sort of the Tolkien of our time. If I were to like predict for the future, yeah. I think he's probably going to be the Tolkien of our time.
Well, he had some terrific series, and then he was tapped to finish Robert Jordan's series, Wheel of Time. He's written a ton of stuff since. The only real beef I have with him is that he keeps coming out with new series instead of finishing the series that I'm invested in. But
that's the life of, I feel like, a fiction reader. Like,
yep, yep. Yeah, I actually have a fiction pick as well that I'll throw out there. One of our past guests recommended that I pick up some books by Alan Dean Foster. And these books were written long enough ago that they're older than I am, but they're the Flinks and Pip books. And she recommended that I go with For Love of Mother Not first, which is actually the fourth book in the original six-book series. But it's the origin story, basically, of Pip and Flinks. And I've been enjoying those. So they're not quite on the level of Brandon Sanderson, but they're kind of a fun read, and it's kind of interesting to see where these go. And it's a sci-fi slash fantasy. It's got elements of both in it. So
I'm trying to look up what books are in the series because I know the characters, but I don't think I read the whole series.
Yeah. Anyway, what were you saying, Dave?
Oh, or if you're a disappointed fan fiction reader, then you must also hate the Fox Network canceling shows after one season. That are like really, really cool, but then they just cancel it.
Any shows in particular?
Fastlane. It was one back in early 2000s. It's kind of like a Miami Vice, but it was an awesome show. They've done that with quite a few.
Yeah, there have been a few that definitely had that. I don't remember if Fox
Firefly
had Firefly.
Oh yeah, I forgot about Firefly.
But yeah, it ran one season and then... It's interesting, too, to see what shows get life after they get canceled or run their course. You know, they tell the whole story and end. All right. Well, John, yeah. I guess the only other question I have for you is if people want to contact you or keep track of what you're working on these days, is there a good place to do that?
My GitHub is always good. And Shiplane is on my GitHub account. That's where I'll be doing the work there. I actually do have a website for my consulting firm, which is down right now, but it should probably be up by the time this gets published. But it's rockagile.io. Hire me. I'm looking for work. And then yeah, I do have a Twitter. If people pinged me more, I would respond. I'm certainly not I'm not the kind of person that's gonna tweet every day. So but I do respond to people, that's for sure. And eventually somebody will twist my arm enough to like tweet about Shiplane or something like that. I don't know. Further down the line.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
All right.
And if you show up in Charlotte, just ping me. I'll give you a list of where to go to eat, or we can go out for scotch or something.
I might take you up on that. My wife's best friend lives out near Charlotte, so.
Oh, definitely do. I have a porch back here if you just want to sit and sip scotch on a porch. I'm telling you, it's life. I don't do it all the time, but do when people come over.
I don't drink alcohol, but I'll come sit with you on your porch.
Maybe we'll make some coffee or something.
Yeah, I don't drink coffee either. Anyway, let's go ahead and wrap this one up. This was really interesting to dive into. Yeah, and John, I'd love to get you on Adventures in DevOps.
So, sure.
Yeah, let's figure that out. And folks, we will have another episode in a week.
Take care.
Talk to y'all later.
Bye.
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 Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.